Vichy authorities. So he would have been amongst the first up on the wall, against the wall, if the Nazis had invaded the UK. And he worked from 1943 for the United Nations War Crimes Commission, which was fascinating because the United Nations didn't yet exist. But the War Crimes Commission was quite a not very well-known body, but was involved in 30,000 investigations into war crimes. This was going on during the war itself, you know, building this. And one of the things you get from Philippe's book is this, that a lot was happening before the Nuremberg trial started, right at just at the very moment the war ended. A lot had already happened in preparation. And, you know, you had Roosevelt with his Four Freedoms speech, you had the United Nations declaration, and et cetera. So there was a lot going on to try and build an idea of what the world would look like if the Allies won. Cassin then went to the United Nations, where, as I've said, he was part of the drafting committee of the Universal Declaration, and a hugely influential actor, such that he eventually won the Nobel Prize. He carried on, and he went on to serve. I mentioned the European Convention. The European Convention on Human Rights was in a way a child of the Universal Declaration and also of the Nuremberg trials, not least because David Maxwell Fyfe, who was along with Lauterpacht on the British prosecution team, went on to chair the drafting committee, played Eleanor Roosevelt's role with the European Convention just a few years later, and that convention was signed up by its first group of signees, if I put it like that, in 1953. So this was all happening very quickly. And the European Convention looks quite similar to the Universal Declaration, but it has, I suppose, two key differences. The first one is that it misses out the socioeconomic rights. But also balances quite, because it had to be a document which could be interpreted in law, because it was going to be a binding on the states that signed up to it. The rights look quite different. Quite a number of them are balanced. So the right to privacy isn't just an absolute right; it is balanced against the needs for the state to protect security and freedom of speech and so on. And the other key difference with the European Convention is that it's binding. Is that of the 800 million plus people who live in states that have signed up to the European Convention, unlike the Universal Declaration, they can go to a court in Strasbourg and enforce their rights, so they can claim their rights. And every state that signs up to the European Convention agrees to abide by the judgments of the court, and therefore it has a binding effect. And it's an extraordinary, it gets a lot of flack, across, particularly in the UK, actually, where the leaders of the giving the European Convention a hard time state, because we've got this strange relationship with European institutions. But it has had the most extraordinary effect, and thousands of judgments on every single aspect of human experience. Just to finish off, the Universal Declaration today, what kind of state is the house that René Cassin built or was the architect of? What kind of state is it in? Well, I guess much like the classical building that Cassin imagined, parts of it have eroded with time. Some of the language seems out of date now. We don't have the gendered language is criticised now. It doesn't include certain aspects of discrimination. One of the big and most important ones that's missing is sexuality, although it comes under other status. So parts of it have eroded to an extent. Other parts have retained their original splendour, but perhaps because they haven't been used very much rather than for any other reason. And socioeconomic rights, I think, although with some notable exceptions, are still the slightly dusty end of the Universal Declaration, unlike civil and political rights, which are reflected in a huge number of national constitutions and international treaties. The I mean, parts have aged remarkably well. And for a 70-year-old document, they work perfectly well now. And that's why it's the Universal Declaration has so many imitators, because it works. These are the rights that do pretty much form the building blocks of a fair and equal society, and they do work. And that is no coincidence. I mean, one of the interesting things that occurred to me while I was rereading the Universal Declaration was how much, if you flip around the rights and you say, rather than the right to, you just say, well, that, you know, that has been taken, that was taken away, you know, the right to liberty, the right to an effective remedy in a court, the right to have your peaceful enjoyment of property. All of these are the rights that were taken away by the totalitarian governments. There's kind of one way of looking at the Universal Declaration, and perhaps one a clue to some of the Jewish influences was that it in a way, it's a kind of negative, a bit like the Turin Shroud, of the atrocities of the Nazis. Because if you switch it round, you see what the Nazis did to the and also and every other totalitarian government to the minorities that they decided to persecute. So ultimately, I think it's fair to say that the house that René Cassin built has, like great buildings of the past, retains a kind of weathered beauty that lasts to today. And ultimately, although René Cassin died in 1976, I think probably we can assume, perhaps hope, that the Universal Declaration will live well beyond him and beyond the 70th anniversary. Thank you.
I think we should throw it open to questions, shouldn't we?
Yeah, let's do it.
But who's going to control the questions? Mia should do it, because we'll be accused. I mean, Mia, you should do it.
Go in groups of three, just okay, to make it manageable. One, two, and three. Yeah? With the red.
Right, you know what other very famous man was born in Lemberg or connected with Lemberg? No?
Millions of them were.
No, Simon Wiesenthal. He's from Lemberg. Oh. And you know that his most important, one of the most important things he said was that you had to pursue the Nazis through justice. It's justice, not vengeance. You had to pursue them through the law. And finally, this is a personal thing. I once gave a talk entitled A Jew for Our Time at the European Association of Jewish Studies, and it led me to my own personal definition of a Jew is, well, apart from a person born of a Jewish mother, it's a person who upholds the law. That's a personal definition.
Yeah, thank you very much. Fascinating talks. As quickly as possible, could you, Philippe, clarify what you said about genocide? Surely it was legitimate and proper to prosecute the Nazis for genocide against the Jews, to prosecute in Rwanda for the genocide there, and to prosecute in former Yugoslavia for the genocide there. This is, as you yourself have made clear, a specific crime, different from violation of important though it is, violation of individual human rights.
Thank you both for your very interesting talks. I have a question which may be an idiot one, and it's to Philippe Sands about, you make a point very strongly in the early part of East West Street that prior to the Second World War, there was no law that prevented sovereign governments from persecuting people who lived within their realms. So the laws that were written by Lautpacht and Lemkin were the laws that were used in the Nuremberg trials. But they were prosecuting people for crimes committed when those laws had not been enacted. Was this simply because the sheer enormity of what had happened was deemed to annul the normal tradition, which is that you have to break a law which actually exists?
I mean, Wiesenthal was indeed from Lvov, and he features en passant in the Ratline, which I'm finishing the book right now, which is the sequel to East West Street and the story of Otto Wächter, because a central part of the story is the belief of elements of the Wächter family that their beloved Otto was murdered, that he didn't just fall ill. And one of the fingers of blame is pointed to dear Simon Wiesenthal. So in the podcast, I didn't really get time to elaborate on that, but I will be doing it in the book, so I'm very aware of that. Now, on the question on genocide, there's just a two-part answer to that. Firstly, the difference between genocide and crimes against humanity in a criminal court is that if 100,000 people get killed unlawfully and systematically, it's going to be a crime against humanity. It'll only be a genocide if you can prove, because they were killed with the intention to destroy a group of which they formed a member in whole or in part, to kill the group in whole or in part. So I've seen for myself, doing international genocide cases, that the need to prove that special intent to destroy a group in whole or in part, the mere fact of going through the assembling of the evidence on that point and trying to prove it, reinforces the sense of group identity in a double way. Firstly, for the victims, who get even more agitated, and secondly, the sense of hatred towards the perpetrators. And I've seen for myself that mere need to prove special intent reinforces in a psychological sense, and I'm not a psychologist, but I can see it, I've seen it for myself, reinforces that sense of group identity as victim and as perpetrator, and that's not a useful thing. Taking the utility analogy further, 2 or 3 years ago, I attended a meeting of an advisory group. It was a very good meeting, and it's a very good advisory group, so it's not a critique in any way, on the UK International Holocaust Memorial Day. And at the meeting, we were explained that Holocaust Memorial Day here in the UK commemorates not only the killings of the Jews, but other acts of horror. Absolutely correctly, in my view, that is the right way to go. And I asked the question, perhaps a little bit innocently, how do you choose the other acts of horror, because there are so many? And the answer that came back was, the Foreign Office has given us a formula, which is always, always going to make your antennae sort of tweak. And the formula was, again, in two parts. One, it has to have happened after 1945. Brings us to the point that the lady mentioned in the second question, which is hugely convenient because it means you can't say anything about the Ottomans and the Armenians. Colonialism is kicked out of the window. So there's that. But then the second part of it is, an international court or tribunal must have given a judgment, the act concerned constitutes a genocide under international law. Ah, I said, I understand. You will therefore commemorate and mark the killing of 8,000 Bosnian Muslims at Srebrenica, but you will say nothing about the killing of 3 million Congolese at exactly the same period. Correct. So the follow-up answer is, what is the social utility of that? Why do we put, whoever they are, a small or one group on a pedestal and say to the rest of the world that the others don't matter? And it's caused me to reach the conclusion that that's just not a socially useful thing to do. Every prosecutor at every international criminal tribunal will tell you that every victim wants their crime to be a genocide. Crimes against humanity, war crimes, just isn't enough. It's just not bad enough. It's not on the front pages of the newspapers. We don't want it to be that. Please, please, please prosecute them. And when it's not, people get really upset about it. So that crimes against humanity or war crimes are now seen as somehow a lesser horror. And I just have doubts as to whether that is really a useful thing to have done. And that it's not that I don't hugely recognise and applaud what Lemkin did. And if you've read East West Street, you'll know I end the book with a nod to Lemkin, but I'm really troubled about it. And I really worry that what he has in effect done is set us on the path to reinforcing the sense of group identity and giving rise to a sense of a biological approach to the law, nationalism, populism, the kinds of things that we're seeing again right now. The question of retroactive justice is absolutely right. It was retroactive justice. I've long thought about dear Hans Frank sitting in the dock looking at the indictment and thinking, what? Crimes against humanity? Genocide? What's that? I mean, these are inventions for things that happened long ago before the inventions had come into being. Now, Lauterpacht recognised it, and he wrote a letter to the Foreign Office saying it is an invention, but basically it's an innovation, as he put it, but one that is important because it merely reflects pre-existing legal commitments, values, ideals, which is a bit of a cheat, really. But it was the realities of the situation. They needed to come up with something, and that's what they did. And Lemkin also recognised that the concept didn't exist. So there has been a problem, and it has, to a certain extent, dogged the Nuremberg trial ever since. And we had to wait another 50 years for the first international indictments for genocide and crimes against humanity in Yugoslavia and Rwanda that were based on well-developed legal concepts. For me, it doesn't, I don't know what you think, Adam, it doesn't undermine the Nuremberg judgment fatally. I think they were in an extraordinary situation and they worked in a matter of weeks. I mean, they literally drafted the charter in 4 weeks in July, August 1945. It's an incredible. Adam makes the point, it's right, that the amount of work they did whilst preparing for war, whilst waging a war, is astonishing. And if you compare the functioning of government then with the functioning of government today, it makes you weep. I mean, it just makes you weep at these, frankly, terrible people we have running our country. I'm sorry, they are irresponsible. What has happened today, I'm not making a party political point today, what has happened today is an utter disgrace. I mean, it's an utter disgrace that we've got to this point. It's not party political, but no. It's just like, how can you do that to a country? And again, back in 42, 41, 43, they were working in committees and they were planning and they were drafting and they were preparing and they were doing it in the national interest and they were trying to come together across the party spectrum. And this lot, on all sides, just no, it's just party politics, it really is inspiring to go back to that period in that sense. There were other problems with that period. But
I'll just add really quickly so we can get on with it. I entirely agree with that final point. The thing that really occurs to me when I look back at that period is how it was a time of unbelievable distress and trauma for the individuals involved. You're talking about Lauterpacht and Philippe's in Philippe's book, the fact that he didn't know what had happened to his family until the end, until he was writing the British prosecution speech against the person who had murdered, he turned out and murdered his family. But the other point that comes out is what a time of creativity it was, just extraordinary creativity, a kind of flourishing of these ideas. And we still rely on that creativity back 70, 75 years ago to found and to guide us today. And I find that very inspiring. That's something to celebrate. But also, that burst of creativity has also itself created an enormous number of institutions and laws and treaties and judgments, and that creativity continues, and that's what I see in the human rights world today when you look at it from a positive perspective. Any more questions?
Thank you very much for a fascinating talk. I think this is directed more towards Adam, but I'd be quite keen to hear what Philippe has to say as well. I was quite struck by sort of the mention of brotherhood in the Universal Declaration. And I imagine at the time that human rights would have been seen very much as a shared project, coming away from this divisiveness and so on. And yet today, human rights so often are portrayed as fights between groups. It's sort of A asserting his right against B. And I wonder what you think we could be doing to try and get back towards a sense of brotherhood and a sense of, I guess, a shared stake in the human rights project.
So we're talking about people who commit genocide, but then we're also talking about universal human rights. So do you think that there are attributes that are inherent to humanity that make them what they are, humanity?
Yeah, several years ago when I was in Washington, I heard a fascinating talk at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum by Judge Richard Goldstone from South Africa, and he was reflecting on his participation in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, and also the Bosnian, was it the War Crimes Tribunal, on the Bosnian genocide. And he called his talk the Healing of Wounded Peoples. And he said, like, in South Africa, people who had been the victims of the apartheid regime knew that they would not get real justice through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But he found there, and also in the Yugoslav Commission, that the victims wanted their story to be heard, and they found it therapeutic for their story to be told in public in front of the persecutors and the national community, and that was enough for them. It's obviously not justice, but I wondered if you had any reflections on that.
On the first question of brotherhood, I think I agree. It's fascinating. I mean, if you talk about the atmosphere around that time, one thing that I would recommend is reading some Arthur C. Clarke books from the 1940s and 50s, when he's imagining the future history 200 years later. And always the United Nations is the world government. And there's a kind of, and we've just got rid of nations, really, except as a sort of historical artifact. And it seems so dated now in the current world, because clearly that's not happening, it's not going to happen. But I think there was a real sense, and one thing I wonder is whether it really came from having a common enemy, that because nothing binds groups and tribes like having a common enemy and fighting together against something which is unequivocally bad for all of your groups together. And I think the challenge now is to build, and I think institutions build those, like nothing else in human society, institutions can build those links, and whether it's economic or social or cultural ties, they are what can build that bigger us. That's the challenge. It's always the challenge, is try and avoid the smaller us's getting into the powerful positions and build the bigger us. But how you do that, I think, is really difficult. Attributes inherent in humanity. I think that modern psychology has a lot to offer here. And actually, there's a lot of work to be done to reconcile the idea of rights and inalienable rights that are inherent to all human beings, and sort of moral psychology. I think it's a really interesting. And I've started to think as rights and institutions are a bit like the software that we load into the hardware, which is just human beings. Because human beings are pretty much the same across all societies in very broad terms. We tend to be very tribal. We tend to be very... We find it very difficult when we're threatened. We close up when we're threatened, and we open up when we're not threatened. And to that, you have to build in an appropriate level of checks and balances to make sure that we avoid the worst of our natures coming to the fore. And I think that's what these institutions really are doing, is they are, and particularly if you look at our democracies, they are sort of building safety valves for our tribal instincts, so that instead of sort of cutting each other up with machetes, we are screaming at each other across in a parliament, which is fine. I'm you know, as much as I can't stand the current politics, and I agree with Philippe, I'm a sort of equal opportunity critic of the current politicians and political parties. It's still a lot better than chopping each other's heads off with machetes. It's what's going on now, and I think that's quite a good thing. and I'll leave the last question, the healing of wounded people, for Philippe.
I mean, on the brotherhood issue, I think, you know, looking back on the history of international law, it's sort of two steps forward, one step sideways, one step back, another step forward. There is a creation, there's then a collapse, and then there's a rebuilding. And the rebuilding is always based on what came before. So I have no doubt in the long term that the structures that we have now will be taken forward and will work better, and that sense of solidarity and sisterhood and brotherhood, etc., will come back. The question is whether we can avoid right now a conflagration. And I think that's what we're heading towards, because I think that there is something, it's not just that it is brewing, it is happening. The polarities, the extremes have widened, the centre has collapsed, and that's exactly what happened in the 20s and 30s. And so I am very pessimistic about where this is going now, particularly coupled with the fact that the United States and the United Kingdom, the two countries that did more than any to give us the multilateral rules-based order, have basically both fallen off their pedestals. And they have disappeared off the top table in a real sense of protecting those values. Now, I suspect they will be back, but by the time they're back, others will have come in, because nature abhors a vacuum. So in the long run, I'm pretty optimistic, but in the short run, I think it's going to be really bad times. And I think Brexit is part of that, and I think Trump is part of that, and I think you see what's happening in Ukraine and the Russians, and it's pretty clear to me where all of this is heading. We will look back, I suspect, on these 70 years as a remarkable interlude in Europe's ability to do incredibly nasty things to each other. I mean, both Lauterpacht and Lemkin were inspired by ideas of common humanity. They had a different way of getting there, but the essential values were the same. And they both also believed that the law and the rule of law as an idea had a fundamentally important value in enhancing the well-being of humanity, not a particular group, not a particular elite, not a particular this, not a particular that. So I think it's reflective in both of their ideas, but they come to it in different ways. In terms of what is justice, I mean, that is a pretty huge question. and we could spend 14 hours talking about it or more. I mean, you might want to read Amartya Sen's remarkable book on justice. It's a short guide to it. But I'm a big believer that there are other ways to the criminal law to doing justice. And Truth and Reconciliation in South Africa was a remarkable thing. It's been less remarkable in other places. In Chile, hasn't really happened in the former Yugoslavia. Hasn't happened at all in relation to things like colonialism. In this country, I mean, you know, we complain about how others do and do not do things, But I mean, what have we done in terms of our historic responsibilities? Basically, bugger all. We are just a great country that has only done fantastic things around the world. And go to Africa and go to Asia, and you'll hear a very, very different story about these things. So a bit of truth and reconciliation at home would be a great thing, I think, and a little, you know, more humility about some of the havoc that has been wrought by the former colonial powers would be helpful. But I don't think the criminal justice system has a monopoly. And I think there is a connection with the rule of law, because where truth and reconciliation has worked, essentially the lever is to tell potential participants that if they voluntarily participate in truth and reconciliation, they can exclude the application of the formal legal order to them for the horrors they may have perpetrated. So there's a very close connection with the rule of law. I don't believe truth and reconciliation is against the idea of rule of law, and I think it is part of a way of delivering justice. But I think we can have a few more examples about it.
We'll have one more round. Lady over there. The gentleman.
Hi, I'm interested in your thoughts on the extent to which international human rights law can act as a deterrent in preventing crimes against humanity and genocide, as well as securing justice afterwards.
I was just wondering, I know that both international criminal law and human rights law are very state-focused, probably because they're a product of their times. And with the exception of things like IG Farben and the Ruggie rules, do you think there's enough scope dealing with businesses or commercial bodies and kind of when they sort of violate these laws? And what would you change about that?
Yeah, sorry. Just picking up the point about the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Justice Albie Sachs came and spoke to Justice a couple of weeks ago, and he talked really very movingly about confronting the person from the South African Security Services that actually blew him up. It was the most moving experience, quite extraordinary. But I just wanted to pick up the points. I suspect I'm not alone in being troubled by Nuremberg, not only about the basis on which the charter was drawn up, but also who it did and who it did not prosecute. I thought it was actually essentially a very political act. I don't really think it was based in law. It was about the victors and the way in which they wanted to give an impression of justice. And I think you could say the same thing about the Japanese trials as well. And I think there's this very political element in international criminal trials, particularly in the context of war and genocide. And you talk about the Armenian atrocities and the Congo. And what's going on now in North America, in the United States, and the breakup of any sense of government in the UK, I'm really quite troubled that the sense of rule-based human rights was possibly never there, and if it was there, it is now disappearing.
I mean, let's talk about Facebook, shall we? Let's talk about businesses and human rights. I think one of the interesting things about the last couple of years is there's only one institution in the world which is grappling with Facebook and can actually take Facebook on, and that's the EU. And I think that dynamic is utterly fascinating, and it's new. And it's no coincidence that Facebook have just employed Nick Clegg to be their, a great Europhile and knows all the European, because they're absolutely terrified of the European Union, which are slapping these sort of billions and billions and billions of dollars fines on them, and having had to, for professional reasons, sit down and with a cold towel over my head and read the GDPR for days and days. I can tell you, I mean, that is a rights-based document which is going to have a profound effect, beyond perhaps any other privacy law in history on businesses across Europe and the world, because it binds Facebook insofar as they live, insofar as they serve European citizens and EU citizens. And I think that whole, if you talk about creativity and progress, I think there's some really interesting things going on with multinational corporations, and the coming years we will see who will be able to stand up to those corporations. And I think, one of the great benefits of the EU is it's big enough and sort of principled enough. I'm not saying it's fully principled, but in this sense it's principled to do that. And it doesn't have it's not like the UK. We're terrified of upsetting Facebook because they've got two huge offices in London. They're employing lots of people and paying very little tax, but it's important for us to have them. And every other country, the United States, the same. So that's really interesting. And I think, aside from the doom and gloom, that's interesting. But and just in terms of Nuremberg, I mean, look, one of the things that I always try to emphasize about human rights laws is how utterly radical they are. And it's easy to forget because they're quite, in our lives, they've been a fixture and they are reasonably old in the tooth now. But no society in human history has ever been based on the principles of equality, brotherhood, and dignity. And every society has been based on principles that are the opposite of it. Every society has been based, in the history of humanity, has been based, apart from one notable exception, which is ancient Israel, which was perfect. and Torah, I'm jesting. But every society's been based on discrimination by the leading sect against whoever it fancies discriminating against. So these are very radical ideas, and they are re-engineering the basic software of human existence. And you cannot expect for it to all just slot into place, because they go against many of our most basic instincts. And that's why you see the steps forward and the steps back. But we do progress. If you want to be cheerful, read Steven Pinker's book, Enlightenment Now. It's a bit overpositive, but it'll make you happy. It's an antidote. It's an antidote to these. But it shows evidentially how on certain metrics things have got pretty much better across the world in the last 70 years in this great time of prosperity and peace overall. So things aren't so terrible, although maybe that's about to flip, and I'll be eating my words.
Well, I mean, I think Adam's absolutely right. I mean, 1945-48 was an absolutely revolutionary moment, and you cannot possibly expect the transformation that was intended not to go unchallenged, and to go unchallenged for many decades ahead. That's essentially what Brexit and Trump and Italy and Orban and Poland and Austria is about. And that's normal. That is how it's going to be. You can't expect to change the world and have those most directly affected by the change to just keel over. Nor can you expect what has been perceived to be as essentially an elite project escape the backlash from those who say this has been imposed upon us. I mean, the point Adam makes is right. Weren't any African countries involved in drafting those instruments? And that undoubtedly is an issue. You were asked about the deterrent effect. There are many, many situations in which the existence of human rights norms, international humanitarian law, international criminal law, have plainly affected the direction of political processes and activities. It's like a law prohibiting murder and penalising murder. It's not going to stop acts of killing by one human against another killing. But over time, it is hopefully going to have some sort of a civilising effect. And the Pinker thesis, which I'm a little bit sceptical about, but happy to invoke when helpful, is part of that. It's a long game. We've really got to think about things as a long game, not what happens tomorrow. And if we look at it in those terms, you see a trajectory, and that trajectory, as Adam says, is generally a decent trajectory. And you know, if you look at places like China, they participate very fully in a rules-based system. They're selective about the rules that they like. Don't like human rights, do like economic rights. But it's part of a change that is taking place over time. In terms of the impact of these laws on the business community, there is a change taking place. I had an advice a few years back on in relation to the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court for certain what one might call corporate crimes. And it is amazing how it concentrates the mind of a company director or employee to be faced with the prospect of criminal liability at the domestic or international level. No international convention, the Genocide Convention, other human rights norms, apply as such to corporations. But that may be about to change. There is finally, after a 70-year hiatus, a negotiation taking place right now under the auspices of the United Nations International Law Commission, in which the special rapporteur is a very dear friend of mine and a wonderful person, American Professor Sean Murphy, drafting a convention on the prevention and punishment of crimes against humanity. And one of the things that happened last summer, which was really interesting and sort of surprised me, was that that draft convention prepared by the 35 members of the International Law Commission, for the first time, has a provision on corporate crimes in an international instrument. And that's plainly the right way to go, and marks now an interesting way forward. Now, whether that will survive the scrutiny of a number of powerful states is another matter, but it's in the draft as it is right now. So that seems to me interesting and something worth watching. I mean, it's a positive development at a time of real difficulty. I mean, the concern with Nuremberg is right. It was a form of lopsided justice. We know that it was, and having been immersed in it for years and years, I can see that. My concern slightly is that that sort of set in stone that lopsided justice is okay. If you go onto the website of the International Criminal Court in The Hague, you will see that every single person who has been indicted is black and African. Blacks and Africans do not have a monopoly on international crime, on crimes against humanity, on genocide, and on war crimes. So something has gone wrong. You know, the whites and the Westerners and the others are sort of off the hook a little bit in relation to the application. And I do worry about that, but you do need, at the end of the day, a sort of catalytic moment, and Nuremberg was that catalytic moment. Not so much for human rights, because that had already been gotten up and running by the United Nations Charter, which was signed a couple of months before the Nuremberg Charter. But international criminal law, in its modern sense, all roads lead to Nuremberg. And personally, I'm happy to pay the price, warts and all, of an imperfect moment of creation for the possibility of hope that it has given us, but I think we have to be acutely aware of the point that you make and recognise its consequence and learn from it.
Yeah, thanks very much. Good evening, everybody. I'm Danny Silverstone. I have the privilege of being the chair of René Cassin, the charity that bears the name of René Cassin. First of all, I want to thank Philippe and Adam for exceeding, I think, all our expectations. And also, I want to thank all of you for coming out in such large numbers. Clearly, we could have continued this conversation for several evenings, asking such interesting questions. And given that we're at the Jewish Museum, many of those questions were clearly unanswerable, but you've made a pretty good job, both of you, at answering them. Maybe next time we should start with some answers and get you to formulate the questions. I'd just like to finish with picking up on Philippe's first comments, which was kindly to lionize the work of our organization, the René Cassin. And I'm holding up the booklet that Mia and our colleagues have just produced in time for this meeting, Making the Jewish Case for Human Rights in the UK. I commend it to you. There are copies up here. Please take one. If you haven't got time to take one, go online and we'll send you one. If you're not a friend of ours, become a friend of ours. If you're not a donor, become a donor, because given what... No, seriously, we are the Jewish voice for human rights in the UK. We live in dark times, and we're needed far more than we were even 2 or 3 years ago. So do stay close to us.
Are you connected with
JCOR? We are connected with JCOR, but we are very much human rights focused, and we clearly cross over in terms of their equality focus. So thank you both. Thank you, Jewish Museum, for hosting us. This is the beginning of a conversation, I'm sure, which will carry on into the 71st and 72nd anniversary. Thank you and good night.
Thank you.